Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Friday afternoon, early July, and a business reporter's thoughts turn to the job market. Okay, not so poetic, but important in an economic kind of way, not the numbers themselves so much. They were pretty close to expectations. What's worth reading is the fine print. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. TGIF, everybody. It's Friday today, July the 6th. Great to have you here. Jobs, jobs, and more jobs. The Labor Department reported this morning 132,000 of them were added to the economy last month. Equally impressive were the 75,000 jobs government statisticians said they missed in the April and May counts. None too shabby for an economy that's supposed to be staggering under the weight of a collapsing housing market and ever-present fears of inflation. The unemployment rate held steady to boot at 4.5%, all of which, when taken together, pose this question. If companies can still generate jobs when the economy's supposed to be stalling, is that perhaps a sign that things are better than anybody thinks? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale went looking for some answers.
The economy appears to be rebounding strongly from the anemic 0.7% growth in the first 3 months of the year. Given today's unemployment report, Global Insight economist Nigel Gault thinks the economy grew 3% or more in the second quarter.
If the economy was going to keep growing at a 3% plus rate, the Fed would be worried and there would be a strong likelihood that it would have to raise interest rates. I think myself, it's unlikely the economy will keep that pace going in the second half.
Gault expects the weakness in housing construction caused by foreclosures in the subprime mortgage market to take some of the steam out of the economy. The White House hailed today's report as the 46th straight month of job growth. But Christian Weller at the Center for American Progress says the economy is only sputtering along.
We find ourselves, I think, in an era of lowered expectations, where a report with only 130,000 new jobs is heralded as accelerated growth or a robust economy. It's neither one of those. It is really a moderate pace at best.
A pace that prompts many to predict the Fed will leave short-term interest rates alone for the foreseeable future. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The immigration bill that collapsed in the Senate last week had one aspect of special interest to high-tech companies. It was a provision to nearly double the number of H-1B visas that are issued. H-1Bs are the visas that highly skilled workers get, visas that often lead to green cards and eventually citizenship. Today, we had what might be the first corporate reaction to the demise of immigration reform. Microsoft announced its expanding operations in Vancouver, Canada. The company said the move is meant to attract talent and to avoid U.S. immigration rules. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Bill Gates has long said easy access to a skilled workforce was paramount for the U.S. tech sector.
You know, speaks to whether the country can stay in the very strong leadership position that it's in today.
Last year, Gates told Congress that Microsoft and other tech companies would be forced to move jobs abroad if the U.S. didn't raise the cap on visas for skilled workers. Today, it seemed Microsoft made good on that promise, with plans to open a software development center in Vancouver, Canada, just a few hours' drive from its Redmond, Washington headquarters. Canada's immigration laws are much more relaxed than those in the U.S. Tech analyst Rob Enderle says Microsoft's move could mean lots of jobs and intellectual capital start migrating out of the country.
It provides an example for other firms. In fact, it certainly opens the door for firms when they're first launching, rather than launching in the United States, to avoid the problem they just launch in Canada.
But not everyone is convinced that more skilled worker visas are the solution. Ron Hira is a professor of public policy at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He says the H-1B visa system is corrupt, and expanding it would only do more damage to U.S. tech workers.
The major users of the H-1B program are the offshore outsourcing firms, and loopholes in the law allow companies basically to pay below market wages so they get cheaper labor.
Hira says if Microsoft truly wants to ensure a healthy IT workforce in the U.S., it should focus on reforming the skilled worker visa program. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Another thing Bill Gates and many others have been saying for years is that America needs to invest more in its public schools. Big cities are among the most cash strapped. In New York City today, some relief and a plan. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has the math lesson.
The city says it'll spend more than $100 million of its new funding to make classes smaller. To do that, it's planning to hire 1,300 new teachers. Teachers won't necessarily get paid more, but the system's earmarked money for more teacher training, school restructurings, and more instructional time. Garth Harries is with the city's Department of Education. He says the system wants to divide up the money more fairly than in the past.
We are focusing our coaching and support efforts on those schools that are low performing, that have high class size. So we expect the biggest gains to be in the sort of outlier schools, which is exactly what you would want to see.
The New York City school system has more than 1 million students. Critics say $100 million won't do much to solve the overcrowding problem, and spreading the money across the system could be counterproductive. Jeff Hennig is a professor at Columbia University's Teachers College. He says classes would have to be much smaller to make a difference. That is, you get much better results by cutting a class of 25 to 12 than to 23.
You take that amount of money, which does seem substantial, and spread it evenly, and you may be getting much less of a payoff than either targeting it to lead to non-trivial reductions in class sizes or investing the money in other kinds of strategies that also may have payoffs.
More teachers' aides or other educational programs, for example. The New York City school system says reducing class size is just one piece of its bigger plan to get better grades. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Investors had the deck stacked against them today, rising oil, rising interest rates, and yet it's going to be the happy music, everybody. We'll have the details and we'll put in a call to the man in Dallas when we do the numbers. We've all gotten used to spin as a political art, the way candidates and incumbents shape information so the public perceives things in ways that are most favorable to the person doing the spinning. And of course, during presidential campaigns, it becomes more important than ever. But commentator Robert Lyle observes spin is present in everyday economic life, too.
Went into my local supermarket the other day and bought a bag of my favorite soy crackers. I was surprised when the register showed I was saving 32 cents on a sale price of $2.87. Now, that amazed me, since for the past year or so, and just last week, in fact, the same crackers sold for $2.79, 8 cents below the so-called sale price. Talk about spin. They raised the price by more than 14%, yet told me, the consumer, they were saving me over 10%. Wow, I can hardly see for the spin I'm in. Nothing new here. It just shows how far down spin or misleadiness has come. But it's worse at the top. Here's a recent tale from Great Britain. The government-financed company, which owns all the tracks and rail stations, Network Rail, announced that its senior executives were having their pay cut by more than 60% because of a series of crashes caused by poor maintenance of the tracks. Boy, talk about having to take responsibility. But wait, it wasn't their salaries that were cut. Those remained at many times the average worker's pay. No, what was cut was their bonuses. The chief executive received only about £89,000, poor chap, just 3 to 4 times the average wage. Other senior executives got bonuses of only 2.5 times a regular worker's yearly pay. In this case, the spin didn't take. When it was learned that lower-level workers were having their bonuses, equal to about 2 weeks' pay, entirely withheld, Network Rail quickly backed down and deferred all bonuses. Well, for now, anyway. Meantime, back here in Florida, where skyrocketing property taxes are driving people out of the housing market or even out of the state, the new governor and legislature took 2 sessions to enact a $25 billion tax cut package. Fantastic! It will actually save the average homeowner a measly $174. I can hardly wait.
Robert Lyle is a semi-retired economics writer. To send us your thoughts, head to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Time to check the week on Wall Street with that guy down in Dallas that we do that with, David Johnson. How are you this week?
I'm here. I'm still here. Boy, it's sure good to hear your voice again.
I will tell you that it is nice to be back. It is absolutely
because, I mean,
nice
I'd heard
back.
These rumors. They said, well, we think Rupert Murdoch bought him and sent him off to reprogram and put in a marsupial pocket or something.
For $5 billion, he could have me, though. I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Good point. Well, we'll see if Dow Jones goes that way.
That's right. What a week it was. You had, first of all, a day off in the middle of nowhere.
Actually, if you want to be picky about it, we had a day and a half off.
Oh, all right.
Because, we were open Monday, and then we were open for 3.5 of the normal 6.5 hours on Tuesday, and then they took pity on us, sent us home. Then you're off on Wednesday. Then you come back and you have these little excuse me sessions. But I'm telling you, this week, this was a remarkable week because on the one hand, it was just frightening as all get out. And on the other hand, as we sit here now looking back at the week, it was a very satisfying week. But I'm telling you, there were frightening moments.
All right. Well, explain the fear to me because that's not a word I hear coming out of your mouth so often.
Well, London, for example. I mean, there was a feeling that there was talk that this was going to be a worldwide thing and that maybe they would hit over here on the 4th of July. And so there was some nervous trading for a while, Monday and Tuesday. And then you look at interest rates. Interest rates, 10-year rates the other day were below 5%. And they hit, 5.19, almost 5.20% today on the 10-year bond, which is a big deal. That's very high.
Yeah, let me offer you this thought, though.
I got more bad stuff here.
All right, go ahead.
I've got, if you're going to erect a wall of worry for Wall Street to climb over, I don't want, some little picket fence.
All right, give it up.
We're talking about the how about an 11-month high on oil?
Yeah, 72
like
something, right?
Okay, and how about a miserable housing market? And I'm beginning to frighten myself. I'll stop right there.
All right, you stop right there, and I will ask you this question. Uh-huh. And yet, lo and behold, in spite of all those bad things, you finished the week in not such bad shape up in New York.
Oh, we finished it in great shape. The Dow Jones Industrials Average is within easy striking distance of a new all-time high, and the S&P is about 8 points away. And IBM, I mean, the old Big Blue hit the highest level since, I think it was early 2002. This was remarkable. And the other thing is, and maybe this is sort of what opened the floodgates, is we found out this week that the buyout is not dead.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a real fear, in the wake of all these private equity companies, the problems with subprime and Congress is going to change the rules. And good old Blackstone comes along and plops down $26 billion for Hilton, a 40% premium, and the game is on again.
Again, and still with David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Johnson, thank you. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Now, look, you get a note if you're going to be gone for that long.
All right. I'll do that. I'm ringing in next time. We'll see you later. Coming up, Mark Twain, author, investor, and inventor.
Business came first, there's no doubt about it. And he didn't sign his first book contract until 1868 when he was at the age of 32, well into his business career.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was the same little lift across the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P. Today, 0.3% is the number. The Dow Industrial's up 45 points to close at 13,611. The NASDAQ gained 9 points to finish at 2,666. The S&P 500 rolled up 5 points to end at 1,530. For the week, the Dow added 1.5%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ turned in the strongest performance over the past 5 days, climbing 2.4%. The S&P 500 gained 1.8%. That stronger-than-expected jobs report pumped up retail stocks. Target leapt 6%. Macy's up 5.5%. Sears gained 3.3%. Rising oil prices took oil companies with them. ExxonMobil spurted up 1.5%. Chevron oozed up 1.25%. eBay cleaned up 3.5% on rumors. Rumors, we say here, of a leveraged buyout. Bond prices fell, as Mr. Johnson was talking about. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 5.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for May. President Bush participates in a White House Conference of the Americas. The focus will be on social justice in the regions. And stop worrying about what to wear, people. The Naturist Society kicks off Nude Recreation Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
On a fine Friday here in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have, if I've got my math right, something like 172 shopping days left until Christmas. Fact of the matter is, though, that most of what we'll be buying 5.5 months from now is already on its way to store shelves, tucked inside container ships steaming over from China. And that's turning out to be something of a problem, because increasingly the word that's associated with Chinese imports is recall. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission has recalled more than 24 Chinese-made toys so far this year. Many contain dangerous levels of lead. Officials recalled the MagSticks building set when an 8-year-old was hospitalized after swallowing loose magnets. Bob Glenn is president of the toys' U.S. distributor, Kipp Brothers. He says the company sent letters to its customers warning about the toys even before the official recall.
You know, it's a tough thing. The public wants cheap toys, and they want cheap everything, and it's hard to get a lot of quality in a 4-cent toy.
The toy lobby is gearing up a new PR campaign to convince consumers its products are safe. Carter Keithley is president of the Toy Industry Association.
We want to do everything we can to reassure consumers that, you know, in 99.9 cases out of 100, they have nothing to worry about. We bring something like 3 billion toys a year into the United States market from China. And so something like this is just extremely unusual.
But how unusual is it? Kipp Brothers' Bob Glenn is concerned enough about lead paint that he started testing his toys after they arrived from the manufacturer.
So we've had situations where we have tested samples, and the samples were fine. And when we received them, we tested them again, and they had lead.
Other retailers are stepping up their safety measures. Toys R Us has reportedly hired 2 executives to oversee products coming from China. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Of course, there's a reason all those Chinese imports are heading our way. They're cheap. Inexpensive is perhaps a more polite word. But when wholesalers and eventually retailers can pay so much less to get something on their shelves, that's what they're going to do. It's a phenomenon known as the China price, when Chinese competitors can make a widget for less using an almost unlimited supply of low-cost labor. American workers might have taken some small comfort in today's report that wages rose 0.3%. But get this. In China, wages are rising by a healthy clip at the bottom end and by whiplash standards up at the managerial level. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Shanghai.
Step inside one of the oldest Western bars here. It's called Malone's. For more than a decade, Malone's has given Western businessmen what they want: burgers, beer, and in many cases, a chance to meet Asian women. Owner Sean Doyle of Vancouver says things are going well here, except that labor costs are creeping up. It's hard to keep good staff.
They know what the bartenders are being paid in the bar down the street and what the waitresses are being paid in the hotels.
So they tell me.
That'll be their argument when they ask for more money is, you know, these guys over here are getting paid this much. I'm like, go ahead sometimes, or sometimes I'll have to make an adjustment, you know.
All across China, salaries are going up an average of 12% a year. At Malone's, the chefs make the going rate of $10 a day, but they're always hunting for a better deal.
People are just automatically thinking and talking about that. And Shanghainese are very conscious of money.
Yes, very important. Very, very important.
That's 30-something Sarah Yuan, an executive assistant at an American investment bank. She has asked us not to name it. In the last 10 years, Sarah has job-hopped 5 times. She says she wants to make a lot so she can save a lot. Financial security is hard to come by these days. In the last generation, the government has shredded the social safety net in China. So for workers like Sarah, they could just sit around and wait for their annual review.
Maybe you will get a raise of around 10% or 15% increase. But if you change a job, maybe you'll get 30 or 40 increase, or even double.
Why are salaries booming now? Sales consultant Andrew Hupert says multinational companies are now coming to China in droves, and there just aren't enough skilled, experienced workers available. So often, these companies poach staffers from one another.
You're either looking over your shoulder to see who's stealing your people, or you're keeping a sharp eye out in front of you to see who you can steal.
Labor costs are inching up for some factories, too, especially the low-margin textile and toy makers who pay migrants just $3 a day. Chip Chaikin of the investment firm Blue Point Capital Partners says China no longer has enough people willing to work under those conditions.
Yeah, I think it's running out of people that are willing to totally uproot their life and take a train 20 hours and live away from their family in a crowded dormitory for a couple years.
Chaikin says today, many migrants have more job options in more locations, so employers have to jack up salaries to keep them. The American Chamber of Commerce says wage pressures are pinching profits at nearly half the American firms in China. And the cost of doing business is going up in other ways. Beijing has just increased taxes on foreign companies and has passed new regulations on labor standards and minimum wage. Add it all up, and China's becoming a pricier environment these days. Still, Chaikin sees no signs of a mass exodus by Western firms. What they are doing is making sure all their eggs are not in the one China basket.
What some have done is they've said, look, China's got enough risks involved with it, including the risk of political backlash from the U.S., that I need to hedge my risks a little bit. So I'm going to have most of my manufacturing capability in China, but I'm going to have a little bit in Vietnam or a little bit in Indonesia or a little bit in Malaysia.
Those countries have cheaper labor than China, but they have their own problems, like corruption and bad infrastructure. They're further away from a lot of suppliers. So for now, most of the game is still in China. It's just that for Western companies, the China price is no longer the bargain it used to be. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Samuel Langhorne Clemens is probably better known as Mark Twain, famous writer and humorist, author of classics like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, renowned observer of the human condition, also a tireless businessman. He made a pile of money inventing and investing, lost plenty too. Peter Krause's book about Twain's adventures as an entrepreneur is called Ignorance, Confidence, and Filthy Rich Friends. He says it's clear where Twain's heart really was.
Business came first, there's no doubt about it. When he was growing up, he worked in the grocery store, he worked at a bookstore, and then, of course, he became a typesetter. And he didn't sign his first book contract until 1868, when he was at the age of 32, well into his business career.
What was that business career? I mean, you mentioned a lot of things. There must have been a couple of highlights that he regarded as his work.
foremost inventor. As soon as he had made a little money publishing a couple successful books, he got into inventing. In 1871, the Mark Twain elastic strap, which held up your pants, that didn't do too much. But then the next year, he invented what he called the world's only rational scrapbook, which may not seem like much today, but it was actually a pretty good invention. Strips of glue already on the pages. You didn't destroy what you were keeping, and it made him tens of thousands of dollars.
Must have had some failures, though, too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. So now he's getting a little cocky, right? And
sure.
And he was always smitten with technology. That's the other thing to keep in mind. When the phonograph came out, he had to have one right away. When the typewriter came out, he had to have one right away. So now there's this new typesetting machine invented by James Page. Has 18,000 moving parts, and Clemens falls in love with it. Or I should say Mark Twain falls in love with this typesetter. And over the next 12 years, he invests literally hundreds of thousands of dollars into it, and it ends up failing.
Do I have it right that he started up a publishing house, too, sort of to keep things going along that line?
He did. And in fact, Twain, I hate to say it, was a bit of a greedy man, and he wanted to make money not only as an author, but also as a publisher. So in 1884, he founds a publishing firm that he names after his nephew-in-law. And his first big score is his own book, which is Huckleberry Finn. But the very next year, he convinces General Grant to publish his memoirs with them.
Which is, if I remember right, one of the best-selling memoirs of all time.
It is. He promised Grant 70% of the profits, which sounds like he's just giving it away. But ultimately, the book earned Grant and his family over $8 million in today's money. And Twain pocketed almost $4 million.
So here you have a guy who's an icon of American literature, but a great part of his personality while he was alive was devoted to business and to making money. Did you get the sense that he was conflicted about that within himself?
He certainly was somewhat conflicted. When he went to sign his first book deal in 1872, he says in a letter to his mother, I'm not going to do it unless there's a good deal of money in it. And he also takes a somewhat self-deprecating attitude, again, toward his choice of writing, which is humor, which was considered kind of base. It wasn't highbrow literature. But then, as you read through his thoughts on his habits and writing and his attention to quality, you also get that feeling that he cared very deeply about writing, literature, the power of the pen, and bringing his reader into the story. So there was definitely a conflict right through his entire life.
Peter Krause's book on Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens, whichever you prefer, is called Ignorance, Confidence, and Filthy Rich Friends. Peter, thanks a lot for your time.
It was great being with you, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, summer flight delays across the country are music to Boeing's ears. The company is scheduled to roll out the first production model of its new 787 Dreamliner up at Seattle this weekend. The model's already flying high with 584 orders as of June. It's the fastest-selling new plane in the history of commercial aviation. It's also set another record. 70% of the plane's production has been outsourced. Boeing says the first test flight ought to happen sometime by late August. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lifted 45 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ bumped up 9 points, also a third of 1%. The S&P 500 was up 5 points. Hey, look at that. What do you know? Again, a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, harvesting and selling virtual treasures over in South Korea. It's a billion-dollar business.
Do you ever stop and think, there's all this money and all this time and effort being built up over these items that don't exist?
I would say never.
All righty then. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll be right back.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.